can. But hey, everybody, this is Augie Davis, Stuntstruck. And so over the years, what happens in the stunt business is that you meet lots of people. And my guest today, I've never actually met, which, but there's a reason to this. To this opportunity to talk to Laurie O'Connell, who's a stunt woman based in Vancouver and originally from Ottawa. I'm still trying to get my head around Canada, such a big country. But a friend of ours, mutual friend Mike Chang, who I worked with on a show many years ago, contacted me to say, hey, this girl Laurie's coming to New Zealand and she's a keen diver and just giving her your contact in case you get time to go diving, and which perked my interest, which is kind of different because everybody knows I love the outdoors and anything that's got a bit of adventure involved. So when somebody wants to come to New Zealand and go for a dive, New Zealand's all year round. I dive in a dry suit. It's cold. It's the islander in me. The tropical side of me makes me dive in a dry suit all year round. So anyway, I have a marine reserve right close to where I was living at the time, so that perked my interest up. But today I'm talking to Laurie O'Connell, as I've said. A little bit of background, and she's actually going to just tell us a little bit about her herself. But apart from the fact that she's a very talented stunt woman, I'm very interested in the fact that she also has a blog and cooking. I've actually stalked her on Facebook on all her cooking ideas and which, as everybody knows, I love food. Hey, Laurie, welcome. Great to have you on the podcast.
Great to be here.
That's really cool. So now, because it's a podcast, nobody can really see what you look like, you know, and just tell us a little bit about, well, it's really time for people to get to know you. I mean, you're a stunt woman. You're based in Canada. I want to talk about sirens because I have a fascination with that genre. And but just Laurie O'Connell, you don't look like an O'Connell to me, right from the word go. I mean, so go on. Where did it all start? Tell us about you.
Okay, I'm pretty complex in terms of that and my origin story, so to speak. So as you know, I'm from Ottawa. I was born in Bermuda. My father was stationed there in the military at the time. My mother is from the Philippines. My dad is born in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. My parents lived all over the place. They met on the east coast of Canada, but then they got married. Well, they got married there too, I think. Then they had my sister on the west coast of Canada, and then they moved to Bermuda for his work. And that's where I was born. And O'Connell's not even my family name. That's my married name originally before I divorced and married my current husband. But it was the name everyone knew me by, so that's the name I kept.
Hey, that's really cool. And, you know, I did an episode a while back with Talena Morwan and Nakora, and we titled it Never Black Enough, Never White Enough, Story of My Life, all that stuff.
So, I actually listened to it. I went through your blog, your podcast, and that was one of the ones I chose to listen to.
It's very interesting. I mean, it's, I don't think it was, we talked specifically to focus on that topic alone, but it was a great conversation starter. And, you know, our colorful background as it's such, you know, Augie Davis, I mean, for goodness sake, no, but if you look at my passport, it's not even that. It's Christina Vondawanga. It's that Fijian Welsh with a little bit of Scots chucked up in there somewhere. That's awesome. So for those of you, at some point I'll put up a picture of Laurie, but I mean, I would almost swear that I was trying to put you in a box just by your picture as stunt coordinators like myself do. And, you know, what criteria. And then I actually watched one of your short films that you produced. And great to know that you actually doubled your Caucasian blonde actress. So that means you're a pretty, your career as a stunt woman has enabled you possibly to do a whole variety of roles. Would that be correct?
That would be very accurate. What's very funny about my, I mean, ethnic me, sorry, ethnically ambiguous nature is that depending on what role I got hired for by the coordinator first, that's usually what they think of me as. There's some coordinators who think of me as being white. Other coordinators think of me exclusively as Asian. Others have no idea what I am. And wow. I've doubled a lot of different ethnicities in East Indian. I think I did First Nations at one point. I've done more Caucasian than anything else. But I think I attribute that to the fact that I, you know, make a conscious choice to not spend too much time in the sun. But yeah, in the last two shows that I worked a lot on, which was The Haunting of Bly Manor and then Siren, they were both very fair-skinned Caucasian women. Bly Manor, I was blonde. And then on, I guess on Siren, and she's a very pale-skinned brunette. But most people, if they see me, you know, with looking like my actress, they think I'm a dead ringer for my actress as a Caucasian. But then I get the exact same thing with my Asian actresses. So I don't know. How would you put me in a box? I think it's like, what's my height? What's my weight? And, you know, like my bone structure is pretty flexible, I think.
Yeah. No, I just saw the trailer to Siren. And I'm glad I did, because I'm actually working with an actress tomorrow who's a regular on that. And that's Rena Owen. And, yes, it's funny. And, I didn't know she was on that. And, but yeah, I really love the scene where she eats the rat. Well, we don't see it, but that's kind of like, wow, that chick, she's tough. We'll cover that later. How do you, stay so pale? I mean, so a bit of background again. So, we became Facebook friends and I think the algorithms, I have to thank the gods, the algorithm gods for it, because, you and I have a very similar interest in terms of outside of the film industry. You spend a lot of time outdoors, kayaking, climbing, and doing all sorts of stuff that, while most stunt people I know are trying to avoid those things so they can not break any bones or get too brown in certain cases. Most stunt people I know in the business spend their days off in the gym or drinking lattes. And it's... as well as riding motorbikes, and that's a bit unfair on all those people who do go out. So just go right to the beginning. So where did the stunt business begin for you? Because I know that you do jiu-jitsu and a whole bunch of other things, and you seem like one of the busiest people out there. So tell us a little bit about how you got into the business, and also maybe part of that is also, and you can just maybe begin with this, when you meet somebody for the first time, how do you introduce yourself? I mean, what do you do when people ask that question? What do you do? Because all of those things could be anything. Yeah,
that's true. I guess I try to just put it in context. 90% of the time when people ask what you do, they're asking what you do for a living. So usually I just, you know, nowadays I say I'm a stunt performer because that's how I make most of my money. That being said, in the past, like I was running a jiu-jitsu dojo for 14 years. It was never a very profitable jiu-jitsu dojo. It was more a passion project than anything else. Something I did because I wanted to give back to the community in the way that jiu-jitsu gave back to me. I took up jiu-jitsu when I was young, and I found that it gave me a lot of mental and physical strength, especially mental though. Like our style, it's not like a very fancy style. I guess the most people would kind of say it's very similar to Krav Maga, in the sense that it's more about application, for civilian self-defense or law enforcement, not so much military, but it's a Canadian style of jiu-jitsu that's designed for the temperament and laws of Canadian society. And I took it up originally in Ottawa when I wanted to learn something that was practical for self-defense. But in the end, I think even though it did teach me that, and it was something that gave me a lot of confidence, and that was something that, as a young person, I thought made me a stronger individual, more dedicated, more disciplined in all my pursuits. And so that was something I wanted to give back by teaching. And originally I thought I was going to be a police officer when I was in my early 20s. I actually applied for the police and I got an interview, and I was pretty far into the whole process before I realized what police did most of the time. And perhaps that wasn't something I really wanted to do. Because I guess I ran into a woman who was not much older than me, who was working downtown in Ottawa, trying to get a homeless person to move along. And she looked miserable and unhappy. And then I kind of had a moment where I was associating that with what I was applying for. I was like, wait a minute, what do cops do most of the time? They make people unhappy. Like, in the sense that, I mean, they do a really very important service for the community, but like the interactions most people have with the police are getting tickets and also, you know, getting bad news and dealing with the crappiest parts of society. And I thought, well, I think what I was finding more appealing was the training, more so than the actual doing of being a cop. And so I had turned down the interview in the end, and I made a very big life choice change. And I decided to apply for the JET program, which is the Japanese exchange and teaching program. And I moved to Japan for 3 years and taught English there. So right. I did that, and I taught, I trained in martial arts there. I even taught at a local community center. I kept teaching my jiu-jitsu there. And after 3 years, I ended up moving to Vancouver. So then that transitions into stunts.
Right. So what brought you to Vancouver, and was it stunts, or was it, what brought you to Vancouver from where you were?
Actually, I married an Irishman that I met while teaching in Japan, hence O'Connell. And he was interested in moving to North America. He was wanting to become an actor. So he applied for the University of British Columbia, which is in Vancouver. And he got in. And I thought, well, you know, Vancouver is pretty cool. And there's a film industry there. And maybe that's something I can do using my martial arts training, maybe get involved in the stunt community.
So what was your connection to the stunt community then? When did the actual interest in the stunt business begin? Was that something that was always there slowly in the back of your mind, or was there a moment that you remembered that kicking in?
It's not like I always wanted to be in stunts, but you have to understand about Ottawa, it's a very government town. The people in Ottawa are very much like, you know, weekend warriors, 9-to-5ers, 8-to-4. They don't really think outside of what people normally do for work. They're office workers mostly. And maybe, you know, like the odd person might become an entrepreneur or something like that. But like, they're all very family oriented and everybody gets a normal job. And so I would never have even dreamed of getting involved in film had I not moved to Japan and met my ex-husband, who is looking to get involved in film. So what really gave me the idea was, well, I know Vancouver has a thriving film community, and I've always enjoyed watching those action movies with all the martial arts. In fact, that's what inspired me to take up the martial arts in the first place, was the original movie was Batman Returns.
Can you tell me who the first person, first stunt person that sort of gave you a lead in into the business? Or who did you contact first in the stunt department when you got to in Vancouver?
In touch with this person ahead of time before I moved there, because it was the only name I could seem to find on the internet of some place where I could train in something even remotely connection with any remote connection to film. And that was with Bruce Fontaine. I don't know if you've heard of him. Oops, you've frozen.
I know the name. Yes, I've heard his name around the place.
Bruce Fontaine.
Yeah, you can keep talking. Ignore the frozen parts.
Okay, fair enough. So Bruce Fontaine was running a wushu school at the time. And that's where I met Mike Ching, actually. And I basically went out and tried his class and told him about my interest in stunts, and he very kindly, trained me and, helped introduce me to people who are involved in film or were involved in film. And through those people, I found out other places I could go to train, like the gymnastics gyms. And then so I just kind of followed, each logical next step to getting involved more and more in the community, learning more skills and trying to be a more useful stunt performer.
Did and when you started, how long ago was that now?
Well, my first stunt credit was in 2005.
Okay, so all right, you're nearly becoming a veteran. I don't know.
Sorry, how long, what did you say? You froze up a little bit.
Then you're almost classified as a veteran in the business now, because actually, on that note, how long does it take to become a veteran in any business?
I wouldn't call myself a veteran because there was a significant block of years where I didn't work at all. And I kind of had to pull out of the industry for a few years because of life circumstances that made it overly challenging to try and pursue it. I had to get a full-time job and support my ex-husband at the time due to some medical issues. But, so for years, I was working a full-time job in an office. And ironically enough, my first week of work, when I was at that office job, I got my first call for Scary Movie 4. That's just the weird way that life works. You finally worked so hard, 2 years of getting nothing. And there wasn't a lot going on in the film industry at the time. So there weren't many opportunities for new people. So I had to call in sick on my first day week of work to go take the stunt job.
That's insane. I'll have to say here as well, the first 7 years of my career, I told people I was a stuntman, but in reality, I was doing odd jobs. And hoping to find that place where I can actually tell people that I was a legit stuntman without having to think twice about other ways I was making a living. That's insane. That's so cool. It's Scary Movie 4. My goodness. How many scary movies did they make in the end?
I think it was just 4, but was there more than that?
I have no idea, but I hope this wasn't because of you. They didn't make 5 or whatever, but, wow, that's insane. Were you working just for the one coordinator? How did it kind of work for you at the start? Did you, how did coordinators find out about you, just by word of mouth or with Bruce Fontaine? Did he give you a first job or was it someone else?
Well, he wasn't coordinating at the time, I don't think. It was somebody else, but it was through a connection that I met through Bruce Fontaine. So they were looking just for a big group of people to be involved in some alien interaction. And they just needed a bunch of people. So I got put forward for it. And I got a few days out of it on that show.
That's so cool. That's so cool. And what was the... So I just want to just try and get in my head. So back then, so you're into jiu-jitsu, you... obviously a sporty person. What was the main skill that got you further ahead into the business, that you, in terms of what you came into the business with? Was it your martial arts or was it any of the other skills that you had that that was perhaps your strength coming into the business?
In my early years, well, I mean, there's my first 6 credits were so spread out, like over many years. One of them was a fencing credit. I doubled three different women on the same show. It was a vampire show where they're all fencers. And there was a fencing team at a university or something, and they had me doubling for 3 different women. Actually, that was for Brett Chan.
Right. Just, I'll just stop you there. So fencing, Had you done fencing prior to coming into the business, or is that something you learned while when you got into, when you started training?
Oh, actually the fencing was before I did jiu-jitsu. From, I don't know, 5, 7 years or so, I competed in fencing, both foil and saber. And I was at a national level for a few of those years. When I quit my fencing career in foil, I was 26th in Canada as a woman. And then on my university years, I was fencing on the saber side of things for the university team.
And I'm just going to speak as a guy who loves big weapons and stuff like that. Fencing is, I still haven't got my head around fencing. You know, these pincy little toothpicks that people point at each other. And it's, one day I'll have to get you to explain to me why you're obsessed with it and got to the 26th in your country. I mean, because I know people who are in it and they're very good. I actually don't know any bad fencers. They're either excellent at it or they just don't exist. There must be something about sport that makes people want to continue to do it. Anyway, well done. So just for those of you who know, Brett Chan was a guest of mine on several episodes back, and the Canadian stuntman, a stunt coordinator. So there you go. There's a link here. Fabulous. What other skills was happening at the time? Fencing? What were the other things that was required of you?
Let's see. Fencing. The first few credits weren't like anything crazy. I mean, there was just, you know, risk factor and being working at a height. Like, it's not like it was based on any real special skills that I had. Later, when, you know, people started to know me a little more, I'm trying to think what kinds of things I was doing. I did falling, a lot of falling, and wire gags were big, where there was a big fall. So a couple of them were the Evil Queen on, what's that show called again? It's escaping me.
This is podcast. Nobody can see you got your hands over your face trying to think hard, so it's absolutely fine. Scratch your head.
I can't believe I can't think of the name of the show. It was around for like 7 seasons. It's like about they're all fairy tale characters living in a story world. Oh my god, this is gonna drive me nuts, but I can't think of it. Hold on,
see,
I should look it up on my IMDb.
This is a problem only people who've been in the industry a while who's working have, you know, they forget the jobs they've done. I remember when I was my first 7 years, I could articulate the dates and how many days. And then now it's just blended into one big era. There was the 90s, the 2000s. And it's probably, I think there was a time, and as you go in the business, I started to delete certain things from my credit. To limit my association with certain shows. But anyway, they were great times.
Okay, here we go. It was... now I'm scrolling to find it. Once upon a time, of course.
Once upon a time. Wow. So, was there any... I'm really intrigued back then. So just so you know... when we started this podcast, you know, the idea was to speak and reach to 18 to 30-year-olds who are coming into the business, who are already in it and considering what the next step may be. And we've sort of got our guests to come onto the show and to the podcast and just talk frankly about their experience. And hopefully somewhere in there, there's some learning that other people can take. And because everybody's journey is so different. And I think that's one of the cool things about the other. And maybe there's just something in those early days that somebody else can resonate with right now. Can I just ask you, those first few years or season of your career, was there a long-term plan in it? Or were you taking things as they come? Because it seems to me, when I was, the more I know about you, you could have been anything. I mean, it seemed like you could have taken anything to its highest level. What was going on with stunts? Was there a fascination with it, or what were you thinking? You know, I'm going to be in this game a little bit longer. Was it about the next credit? Just what was going on?
I wish I could tell you I was one of those people that was super talented and had this one skill that was just above and beyond everybody else in the industry, and that's what got me in. But I wasn't that person. And for a long time, like, I just get a credit here, a credit there, and not because I had any special skill that they needed, but I happened to, you know, I happened to be available, and they needed somebody who looked roughly like me. And then later, when I started, and because I wouldn't say I commit so fully at the beginning of my career to my training and development, because I was so split with having to work full time and then trying to, you know, figure out a way to balance that and try and get into stunts. So my interest would wax and wane over the years, depending on how busy I was with my other work. And then eventually I got laid off. And then I kind of used that time to think, you know what, maybe this is my time to try and push harder. And I started taking this stunt fighting class with a guy named Kurt Cowett. And he was training people at fairly high level fighters. So I really improved my reactions, my flow, and my choreography through that. And he kind of took me under his wing a little bit and helped me out and, you know, promoted me to people he knew eventually. I actually got a credit working on his feature film. It's called Velvet. Or did they change the name? No, Promised Land. They changed the name to Promised Land. And on that one, I was attacking him, but they didn't need any women performers. It was all men. So he dressed me up in a hoodie, and then I got to be I looked like an 18-year-old dude with like a goatee. It was pretty funny.
With all that, when in all the jobs that you've done, did you kind of feel like that you've sort of arrived at a certain level? I guess where you could say, I know it's just for the purpose of a timeline, when did it sort of begin to feel like that you're a stunt woman? I'm here.
I started calling myself a stunt woman in, I guess, 2017. I had earned it and was legit and wasn't doing any other work but stunts.
So what, 12 years after you started?
Well, I mean, like I said, there was some gaps, and like, I don't pretend to be a 12-year career stunt performer. There was a lot of gaps. You know, I would say more like it was 8 or 9 years would be a bit more accurate because of the time I took off.
Well, that's really interesting. There seems to be a pattern going on with people that I've talked to about when that moment arrived, you know, 6 years minimum, it seems like. It's a minimum 6 years. Fascinating, really. So, you know, looking ahead, you know, you've got this collection of life experiences and obviously a variety of work. Do you see many opportunities for you apart from performing, obviously, because I think you'd never stop performing as a stuntie. You yourself coordinating, directing second unit and things like that, because obviously all those things seems possible to you.
Actually, I did my first stunt coordinating gig last month.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you. It was for a short film. A friend of mine got the Canada Council grant for her short film called Kiri and the Get Dead Girl. And it, you know, it wasn't something out of my realm of, like, I mean, being a new coordinator, I wouldn't take something on that I thought was more than I could handle. I wanted something simple that I knew I could apply my knowledge and skills to. And I'd also taken, there's a few training programs we have through our union that help us to be better equipped for coordinating and creating stunt action plans, and so that we're all, you know, coordinated with the production team to make sure everybody stays safe. So it's basically like a safety plan. So I took some training in that through the union. And then when I got this offered this opportunity, I said, well, let me take a look at the script first, because I wouldn't want to take something that I thought was beyond my abilities. And really it was, you know, there was a child and she's going to be running through the woods and climbing up on some things. And so in some ways that's way harder. In some ways it's way easier in the sense that the actions were all quite simple and there weren't a lot of, you wouldn't think there'd be a lot of things that could go wrong. However, I'm sure you've heard that saying in the industry that the two things that are hardest to work with are children and animals.
Oh yeah.
And you'd be surprised at how children can find ways to make it less safe.
No, that's right. And I always say, you know, the people that you've got to convince the most sometimes is not the children, it's the parents. And in many cases, a producer who's losing a stone of weight just by worry. How was that? Did the bug of coordinating, is it, did you like what you did and you like the challenge and you like the result? Is that something that you would pursue more?
I think I would, actually. I mean, gradually. I don't want to take on more than I'm ready for. I mean, like, I wouldn't mind doing more of these kinds of things where I can kind of work on risk assessment skills and just communication with different departments and with the kinds of stunts where the hazards aren't, they don't have as a big of a risk that could be of things that could go wrong. But I also have some great mentors that I can call on. So even for that one, I worked on my stunt safety plan. I went through the details. And then when I thought I had a good plan, I called up Ed Anders, who's the coordinator I worked with on Siren. And he was the one that kind of encouraged me, thought I had the chops to eventually get to work and that sort of thing. If I wanted to pursue it, he encouraged me to develop my skills in that regard. So I asked them to look over what I'd done and, you know, to get some other insights and to see if he had anything more to say. But really, he just confirmed that I seem to have everything under control. And it's just nice to have that support so that I, you know, have the confidence to say, yep, you know, I've crossed all my T's and dotted all my I's. Now, that being said, there was some parts that were not listed in the original descriptions that I would get there on the day and was like, oh, well, this is way less safe than I thought it was going to be. And this isn't the location I didn't. And there were stunts in there that weren't described in a way that to me that I thought they were going to be stunts, like running in a, there's this part where she's following one of the little girls following another girl through the woods. And they weren't planning to have me there for that. But when I saw the location, I'm like, oh, this is not the best location for safety. And when they were going around the corner and going on their end mark, it was very tilty and there's lots of roots. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to stand here and then spot them so that when they land on their marks, that they're not going to accidentally go down and fall in a bad way. And you'd be surprised. Like, I thought they were, you know, if it was an adult doing that action, there wouldn't have been any issue, but they're not so aware of their surroundings and a little unsteady on their feet. And so I wasn't confident that they necessarily would land without tripping or, not that there were any tripping hazards, but, you know, when kids are a little awkward in their growth phases, they aren't the best at figuring out where to step and how to maintain their balance, if you know what I mean?
Yes. How old were they? Just out of interest.
One was 9, the other was 11 or 12. It was the one that was a little older that was, you know, a little less steady. I think she'd had a growth spurt and then perhaps a little more unsteady.
That's very cool. Well, good on you. And are you seeing, like, are you right now, do you see a pathway that will make your coordinating journey whether easier or harder, I don't know, but is there a pathway available in Canada for you to, you know, to get that dream coordinating role for you? Is there a clear pathway for you to help you along this journey in Canada? Or is it something that you're just going to have to create with other people on your own?
Well, they're working on now to having a little bit more clear on guidelines for people who want to get involved in coordinating, like certain number of days on set, people who are vouching for you as a performer, that sort of thing. I don't know if it's fully laid out yet, but they are working to make it a bit clearer so that those who are interested in becoming coordinators, you know, can have more clear steps on what they can do to pursue that path. I don't know, like, it's still in development from what I can see, though.
Laurie, just on that, so when you did this coordinating job, how much of, obviously, you know, your performing experience is one of those key qualifications that justifies your existence in the stunt business, because you've been there performing, and there's not a stunt man or woman I know that goes through this business without performing. I mean, there's people who fall into rigging at some point, but they've always come back to perform. What other skills and attributes do you think that you have that do you think went towards the ability, your ability to be able to step in and say yes to coordinating? What other things that in your tool belt that you have that enabled you to sort of say yes to a job of taking on this role as a coordinator right now? I mean, the fact that you're a stunt woman, what other things that you have? I mean, I know that you can write and you can, means you can take notes, you understand how to read something. What other things that you have? I mean, I know that you know how to assess risk just from your life experience as an adventurer, all those things. What other skills, attributes, came in useful when you're looking after these children?
Communication skills, definitely. Like just being able to connect with the performers that I'm working with so that they feel comfortable doing the things that they're doing, learning what I'm asking them to do in a safe manner. Also showing the parents that I am doing that too, like taking the time to come up and make sure that the pads fit them and make a personal connection, especially with the children, because I want them to feel confident and emotionally secure, you know, and because they're trying to act in addition to doing these physical actions, and the acting can distract from one the physical, while the physical can also distract from the acting. So, you know, if they're so focused on the physical that it impacts their performance, that's no good. And same thing, vice versa. They're so focused on their acting that they're doing something unsafe. That's not good. So I think one of the big skills was just trying to get inside the head of the performer and how they want to act their scene, what the emotional content is for them, and how that might affect the way they move physically. Like, for example, one of the things that we had to do in that last show was at the very last scene of the night, of the whole shoot, actually, there is a scene where she's walking through the woods and then she looks up and this big, big raven. Yeah, she sees a raven, she looks up at it, and then it flies off, and then she's showered with a whole bunch of feathers, of black feathers. And the original action was that they had a big box of feathers that they were going to kind of shake and let them kind of gently fall on her. And this wasn't something that was listed as a stunt, of course. It was something that I heard about, and then I said, well, I want to take a look at these feathers. And then I saw that the feathers, you know, the stem of the feathers, they were really sharp and pointy and stiff. They weren't like, you know, pillow feathers that are fluffy and mm-hmm. soft and go like this. Like, if that thing went straight down with the stem onto her when she's looking up, I'm like, that's a pretty big hazard. I didn't even want to do that for me. Like, I, as a stunt performer, I'm like, I don't think that anyone should be asked to look up with pointy things coming down on their eyes. So, and when I figured that out, I was like, okay, well, I don't want you dumping them straight on her when she's looking up. Let's have her be a few, like, let's cheat it you know, have her be a few feet back and then do the feather drop in front of her and have, but I also, even with that, the feathers could fly toward her. So I said, I don't want her looking up when the feathers are falling. So if she looks up and then when the feathers start falling, she looks down, I'm okay with that. But then, I said, let's try a rehearsal with me. And even for me, like the desire when somebody says, okay, the feathers are falling, the natural inclination is to look up because something's coming towards you over your head. You naturally look up. Everyone does. Even me, when knowing the feathers were coming and I knew what the action was, there was that moment of my neck wanted to crane up. And I was like, oh, look down, look down, look down. And I said, okay, well, I need to be near her while she's doing the action because she's going to want to look up because it's natural. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to tell her every movement. She's like, okay, the feathers are falling, are going to fall. So now look down. The feathers are falling. Look down. Stay looking down. And every so often I could see her. I'm like, keep your eyes down, eyes down, eyes down, you know, like, and this is how it went. And then of course, it didn't really look great. It wasn't working out because it was just hard for her to perform and be, you know, constantly wanting, not sure where to look. So ultimately they decided to just go with CGI and then they got rid of the feathers altogether so she could look up and not worry about hurting her eyes.
It is, it's so interesting listening to you. And I would have to say that, you know, I've been coordinating now for 20 or so years. And those kind of jobs never stop. They were there at the beginning, and I'm just, the other day, there's somebody, I think it's because there was a stunt coordinator on set, they still come up with new ideas that was not even the script. So get used to that, I say.
Well, I think part of the problem, I mean, it's not a high budget. It was a low budget show. I mean, they had a grant, so they weren't like, it wasn't a no budget show, but, I guess they're new, you know, like they don't know what constitutes a stunt. They also had to go through several different ADs because of the way the schedules change or, you know, availability has changed and stuff. So even like, you know, if you have an AD that's coming in fresh and hasn't had a chance to review everything, it's going to make a difference in the way things get planned.
Mm. And take us back to when you produced and acted doubled in your own short film. I think it's called Inner Demon, right? And how was that experience compared to your coordinating job? Who coordinated that? Did you have a coordinator or did you look after that yourself?
Oh, Kirk Cowett coordinated and directed.
Right, gotcha. Okay. So obviously that was a dream job because everything went to schedule, I take it. And how was that? How many days did it take to shoot?
It was a very long day. One day.
But, I have to say, it was you guys did really well masking you. And whoever did your hair did a really great job. And I did wonder how are you, if that was you. And I saw the credits in the end, and it was. And I thought, well, you are whiter than I thought. And it's well done. Hey, so the industry now in Canada is seems like it's starting to take off again. I understand the other day that there's about 40 productions about to kick off in your side of town. What's generally happening at the moment? Are people rushing to get back to work? I mean, and someone like you, I mean, what's happening with Sirens? Is that going to go again another season or what's,
sadly,
what's the later?
Siren got canceled.
Oh, really?
Well, yeah, I'm choked about it. I was, you know, hoping for another season. So, you know, I'm relatively free agent. I've got a few bookings coming up, a day here, a day there. Not a consistent job just yet, but my husband, he's a lot more busy right now than I am, thankfully. He's a stunt performer.
Ah, okay. Well, there you go. I did not know that.
I got him into the industry, actually.
Well, that's a win. How does that work with both of you being in the business? I mean, how many jobs have you worked on together?
A couple more than I expected we would. There's one on Upload where I was doubling the lead and he was an assassin trying to kill me. So that was pretty fun. Yeah. I jumped out of a two-story window and he chased after me. And then recently we also worked on Bly Manor together. He was actually, he was the stunt double for my fiance in it. And he did some wire ratchets for a car hit. And then he also did an underwater day as well. Actually, in a very funny situation, he was doubling the same character as me.
Oh, right. Okay. I've had a few complaints from the podcast because I do a little bit of water work and a lot of my water buddies in the industry kind of go, you're talking too much about martial arts, man. And I'm just going, well, you know, unfortunately, those are the people who get a lot of work in my industry. could you just tell us through about Siren? I mean, here's to all you water babies out there. Here's how Laurie O'Connell got to become lead double on Siren. How much stuff in the water have you done underwater prior to Siren?
Underwater, not a lot. I mean, I did a couple of days, one on Dirk Gently and then another on Altered Carbon. They were just very quick ones. One of them, you know, like we had to hold our breath underwater and then pop out of a lake like we'd gone through a portal and ended up in another dimension or something like that. That was a cold water day. It was like early June in a glacier-fed lake area. And we were in and out of the water for about an hour and a half. And like, I think the water was like 5 or 6 degrees Celsius.
Wow. And and free diving, because that's what you did a lot of with monofins, I guess, and on Sirens. And did you seek specific training for that before you got the role, or was that something that was incorporated into your preparation for the shoot?
Well, what happened there was I'd done some water training with Roberta Senedes. She's our local free diving kind of cold water expert, and she does a lot of the dive safety for shows. And I knew that Siren was coming up. I'd done some training. I'd had a couple of water days already, and I was interested in getting more involved. And with Siren coming up, I thought, well, maybe they're going to need more mermaids. I know she teaches monofin technique, so I'm going to hire Roberta to give me some private training in monofinning. So I booked a 3-hour private lesson with her, and she gave me a foundation so that I could keep training and improving my monofin skills. And then eventually when they were looking for somebody for the show, I sent a video of myself doing the monofinning, and they didn't have anybody that could double this woman. And they're like, okay, well, let's bring Lori in. And originally when I was booked to work, and this was for the lead mermaid on Siren, I didn't know. I thought I was just going to be doing one of the, you know, like another mermaid or something. I didn't realize I was up for the lead, but it was just for the water work. The thing was that prior to Siren, I had a lot of shoulder mass. I was a bit bigger up here from jujitsu and various other kinds of training that I did. And I think that was a lot of the reason why it was hard for me to get more work earlier on, because I just didn't look enough like actresses my height. Actresses my height, 5'4", they tend to be a little narrower in the shoulders, slighter frame. And that just wasn't me at the time. So in my first year working on Siren, all I did was the water work for that, you know, as the monofinning and underwater double. And I did some really cool stuff in the water for that. But I knew she had other stunts. I knew there was lots of other things going on, but I wasn't being used for that. And I knew it was because she's very small. Like if she was in a very tiny frame, and I knew there wasn't, you know, a chance that I was going to be able to double her on land, because in the water they were using CGI. It didn't matter as much. Anyway, so when I heard Siren was coming back for season 2, I kind of decided this was going to be my motivation. So I reached out to Ed and I said, look, I am very interested in working more with you. And I know that there's other stunts for Rin, for my character, that are on land, but you probably haven't thought to use me because I'm a bit bigger than her. And like, this was like 4 to 6 months before Siren 2 happened, even before they announced Siren 2. I felt like Siren was going to happen in season 2. So I said, you know what, I'm going to train as though it is going to happen. And I'm going to, like, what if I were to say that in 6 months' time, if Siren comes back, if I'm able to slim up in the right way, would you consider hiring me for the land-based stunts as well as water? And he's like, you know what, I like you. You're very professional. I like working with you. I would love to be able to. And so if you are able to do it safely over time, like, he didn't want to encourage me to do something unsafe and, you know, try to lose 10 pounds in 10 days, that sort of thing. But he said, if I can do it in a way that's healthy and, you know, if Siren comes back, I'll take a second look at you and put you forward if it's appropriate. And that's exactly what I did. For 6 months, I figured out what I needed to do to reshape my body so that I could do it. And I was able to do it. And I got hired to do all the stunts for my character on that show.
Well, good job. Well done, you. And so that was what, 2-3 seasons that show went for?
Three
seasons. My goodness, I love the trailer. And it's cool. I'm just going to share with you. So a few years ago, I did a movie with a really talented actress. And she was the hardest person to double I've found in my career. And this was Shailene Woodley. And I said to Shailene in a private conversation, you know, if you ever decide to give up acting, just become a stuntie, I'll take you on. She's very much a water baby. She's very talented in the water. And one of the neat things about it was that she was one of the hardest people I had to find a double for, just because the nature of the movie that we did together, called Adrift, she was in tropical clothing, I guess you'd say, you know, so wasn't much to cover. And she had a very unique silhouette. That's the way I would put it. So a lot of girls that I looked at who are in the stunt business, who are very talented, spend a lot of time training in gyms and places, and their measurements stacked up, but their silhouette just didn't quite look the same when you put them against, when they're walking on the decks of the boats and the way they moved. It was very hard. But that was just one of the results of somebody who spends her life doing ordinary things, I guess, out there in nature, doing what you do, canoeing and climbing and surfing and swimming in the ocean. She was and she became very hard to double in the end. And the product ended up become a very good film. And one of the reasons was we were able to just use a stunt double to line up the shots, and she ended up doing a lot of it anyway, because 97% of that film she did all her own stuff, underwater, swimming, into all sorts of things. A great result. So how tall are you, just out of, now that I'm thinking that, you say you're 5'4"? 5'4". Oh, wow. So, all right. So that's, gosh, that you can't tell that from where I sit in terms of what I've seen on screen with what I just saw before on Sirens. So just on Sirens, what was the standard week like on that show? Because obviously, how often were you in the water versus your time on in a harness or doing other stunts for this character?
Well, let's see. They were spending a lot more time out of the tank in season 2. Because I think water shooting is fairly expensive. So we did, you know, everything we do in the tank, it would be all compressed in the same, or like within like a week or so. Like if there were two episodes and back to back that had water in it. They tried to have all the water stuff close together so that the shooting would all kind of flow together, and then they'd block shoot a lot of stuff. And but I'd say it was more like 2/3 non-water, 1/3 water.
Right.
And my actress did most of her own water performance work because they wanted to see her face doing the acting, of course. I was mostly lining up the shots for her. But then also in season 3, they needed a lot of other mermaids because they had ND mermaids. I got to play like, you know, 4 or 5 different mermaids with different wigs in season 3, which was great, you know, getting to be my own character. In one scene, I'm just a dead mermaid, like, and they do a big close-up of me dead in the water, and that was pretty cool. I did a lot of fighting in the water, too.
What was your what was the breath hold time you were doing at your best on a sort of a static, an ordinary day? What was your best breath hold time? Did you during that period?
Well, it's what I do at work is different from what I can do. Mm. At work, I never had to hold my breath longer than 45 seconds.
Yep.
But I can do 2 minutes.
Well,
no problem. That's not swimming. That would be just a dead breath hold, like where I'm floating.
Static, yeah. That's really cool. You know, I've done, when we're training actors, it's minimum really for actors, 30 seconds. The cinematographer goes, I need 30 seconds while I get myself sorted. If they get them to at least 30 seconds, that's what they want. Well, good job. And can you just tell me what was the structure of the team at on Mermaids, if you don't mind sharing? So there's yourself, the double, and were you on full-time, or how does that work on a show like that?
I wasn't on full-time because it wasn't a stunt-heavy show. It was a little more of a drama than it was a big fighty show, although we did a lot more fighting in season 3 than we did in 2. That being said, I got to do some pretty cool gags when I did get to go to work. I did a car hit in season 2. I broke through a plexiglass aquarium as well. That was pretty fun.
I think I saw that on the trailer, right? That's pretty cool. That's a good break.
Yeah, that was cool. Like, they had a couple of charges in there so that when I went into it, it just was fun. And then spear fighting. In season 3, there was a lot of land-based spear fighting. So I got to help, work with the actresses and help them with, you know, flourishes and, you know, put together their fight sequences. And we also did some fights in the water with the spears, which was interesting.
That's so good. How much of your, did your teaching background in terms of, the martial arts teaching that you do, did it come in handy? So were you able to share the skills to your actors?
Absolutely. It definitely helps because it's different when you teach a performer or who already knows how to fight and has done a lot of martial arts than it is to work with somebody who has no background. Now, my actress was great. She has a dance background, and she was really keen to become, you know, to do fighting. So she put in a lot of time training and practicing to make herself look good so that they could use her doing things. So we'll get kudos to her for being willing to work on it so hard. I even like, you know, there's a couple of moments like where there's a shoulder roll and she really wanted to do the shoulder roll. And like, I have a really extensive background for teaching break falls. So you just take it one step at a time, learn. I know how to teach it to somebody who's never done any martial arts or it has no physicality to speak of. So if I can teach it to somebody with no background at all, then I just take that and bring it to work with me and then, build their confidence and, you know, take it one step at a time so that they feel safe and comfortable and, it does definitely help to be able to break things down like that.
Wow, that's really cool. So during Sirens, you know, for that 3 season, did it enable you to sort of commit to others' project going on at the same time? because, you know, you live in a city where there can, there's just so many things going on all at once. And of course there's continuity issues on the show, and you know, they rely on your availability, and sometimes some of those gaps can be quite wide. And were you able to fit in times on other shows?
Yes, I was. There were times where I'd have an episode where they kind of had one episode that would be stunt heavy, and then they'd have an episode that'd be drama heavy. So it would go back and forth. And, you know, Ed was great about communicating with me what the show, what the needs were going to be like for the next episode. So I have a better idea of what my schedule was like. But that being said, my first commitment was to Siren. So, you know, if somebody would come knocking, I'd always check in with Ed first before I said yes, so that he have right of first refusal. He'd double check with the production, make sure that there's not going to be any changes. And then he'd say, yep, go ahead, take that job. Because he wanted me to have as many opportunities as I could have so I could grow as a performer as well. And, you know, by working on Siren, of course, I got more water opportunities because I became known for being good and with in the water with my breath holds and being able to do, you know, more challenging things that most other people might not feel comfortable with the breath holds. So part of that, it led to an opportunity on the 100, where I was, you know, swimming in full armor underwater.
Wow. There you go. What was that? The 100, is that a series that's on at the moment, or is it?
They just finished seasons. I think 7 seasons they had. It was on Netflix, as well as network TV.
You know, I should take more notice about what's going on Netflix, and because the 100. Yes, now I know. Yeah, of course. Wow, what a Well, that's what an opportunity. This is a problem now. There's no days. As soon as you hear somebody who can hold their breath and can do underwater or water stuff, everybody wants them, it seems. Seems to be a rarity in the business. Everybody says they can swim, but very few can actually hold their breath and are comfortable in the water.
Yeah, and, it definitely opened up a lot of doors. I mean, if I had just stuck to, you know, what I thought I was best at, which would have been martial arts going in, my career wouldn't have developed as well as it did in the last few years. The water stuff really opened up a lot of opportunities. And water was never like my big thing. Like, if anything, it was something I came into like in the last couple of years just because of interest, because I thought it was cool. I took that training with Roberta and I enjoyed it. And I just kind of pursued it out of interest more than anything. And I happened to luck out with that Siren, getting in to Siren, because they couldn't find anybody else that could do it and had the same rough height and weight. You know, it just goes to show, like, you know, when you see an opportunity and strike when the iron's hot, you know, like that's how you get opportunities, is just by being willing to do other things, not necessarily tunnel visioning into one thing. I mean, I got another job one time. It was a butterfly knife thing. It was hand double, doing butterfly knife. And my friend, my Kirk called me up and was like, hey, are you okay with a ballast long with a butterfly knife? I'm like, yeah, I can do a few maneuvers. I'm like, it had been a long time since I'd played with a butterfly knife. But he's like, okay, well, can you put together a little video of you doing some simple, you know, hand transitions and stuff? I was like, yeah, okay, I can do that. I practiced, you know, because I wanted it to look good. And, you know, so I, you know, got my skills back. I was like, okay, so I did a few things, put it on camera. I sent it back to him. And then, like, within a half hour, I got a half hour to an hour, I got a call. It's like, okay, yeah, they need you. Go to set right away. I was what? It's like, they needed somebody, like, ASAP. So I literally, after sending that video, like, I was like, okay, yep, go to set right now. They're waiting for you.
That is just the business for you, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, you never know what skill may be required at any point in your, I always say to people, be careful what you put in your resume, because somebody will hold you to it, you know, even if it's from 20 years ago. I was just thinking about the water stuff, and also while you're there, it's, the amount of specialist water people that we've had to bring on shows, it's just because, you know, there's just not many people to do that. And we've had to spend a lot of time training people as well. I can just recall on my friend who did Alita Battle Angel, just needing a woman who can walk underwater while they capture that. And also Ghost in the Shell having to bring in specialist water people to do replace Scarlet for some of her work. And of course Avatar, they've seen, they've spent a lot of time training people to breath hold because they were capturing underwater, I believe, for that. So that was an opportunity for a lot of people. And it's and I guess it's a bit like riding horses, I guess, in some respects. You really need to spend your time with the animals and you need to be in the water. It doesn't really matter to me what I've observed. I think if people can swim and swim regularly, you can adapt a lot of water stuff much easier as opposed to just coming in fresh. I've always felt that if you can play in the water, then you can work in it. It's very hard just to find people to just come and work because it's just not very productive in most cases. People take it for granted. What we have here in where I live is that a lot of people will always say, yes, I can swim and I'm happy in the water. But what that actually means is that over summer, they stand in waist deep water and dive into the surf and stand up again. Very few people can actually tread water for long periods of time or comfortable controlling their buoyancy and then underwater. And as soon as you put a weight belt on you, you know, the brain starts to take over and feels like you're going to drown. And so we've had to learn that the hard way over the years. So well done you for putting in the work, I'd say.
And then there's also the fact that everybody here that is required to have their paddy for any, if you have to do anything where you're on a regulator, for liability reasons, we all have to have either paddy, open water, certification. In my case, I have my advanced, so I have more than enough with that. But, I think there's like a certain depth you're only allowed to go to if you don't have paddy. I don't know if that's the case out there for you guys with your water requirements.
Yeah, generally speaking, it's there's PADI, SSI, and NAUI, lots of organizations who have standards. And I recommend open water is really cool because one of the things about that training, it teaches you how to use equipment. And because that's a bit that people struggle with is just things like, over the years, the most useful skill that you learn to use, is, apart from breathing on the regulator underwater, is just clearing your masks. And very, very few times will you ever need to go beyond, 5 meters. There's not a tank. There's not many tanks deeper than 5 meters. And in most cases, if there's a camera down there, you're not going to go past 3.5 meters. And open water is it's a different skill altogether.
And, our tanks were two stories.
There you go. Where was this tank that you guys were?
It was built at one of the studios here.
Oh, so it was built especially for Siren?
Yes. And then we also had a tank for Bly Manor for the lake, for all the underwater sequences on that show.
Right.
And I mean, the whole thing with Patty too, like, you know, the regulator, knowing how to use a regulator properly. Like, I think it's important not to be doing this for your first time when you're working, because like it feels weird sometimes for people to breathe compressed air and they can't relax into it. So if you have to do a breath hold underwater and your starting mark is with a regulator and then you have to take out the regulator and then do your action, sometimes people find it hard to breathe calmly on compressed air if they're not used to it.
Well, that's absolutely true. And what do they do with that tank that they built for Siren? Are they taking it down?
Oh, I guess so. I mean, it's. I'm sure that it was at Vancouver Film Studios, so I'm sure they're using that studio for something else now.
Wow.
I believe at one point they were sharing it with something, another show, but like that was ages ago. Like, you know, Siren hasn't. Well, like we finished shooting season 3 last year, so they took it down after that.
Wow, so rare to find a really deep tank. And I know they were building it especially. I think the closest one I've, 7 meters, I think is the deepest permanent one I've seen. I think it's in Malaysia somewhere.
I loved working tank days on both on Siren and on Bly Manor. It's just, it's so controlled. Like when you have a big, deep tank to work in, there's so much room to move. And like, it's such a fun day in the tank. Like, and it's heated. Like, it's not like doing a day where you're doing something out in the ocean. And there was a couple of those too.
Well, when we're not recorded and some other time, I'd love to, if you can share with me some of the pictures of especially the tank and some of the work you did. I'm really fascinated with that. It's because it's such an asset to have. And the fact that shows like Siren have committed to it, I mean, it's great. Are you free diving recreationally? What's going on there? Is it, because that's a really valuable skill you don't want to lose. Are you continuing with that?
I do it a little bit casually. Like my husband also has done some free diving. So, you know, we'll spot each other when we're doing vacation kind of free diving and stuff like that. I haven't been doing like the kind of competition oriented stuff where they're like going down the line and like, it's just not something that I, you know, have time to commit to. But I do things on my own time to keep my skills sharp, like breath holding every day. I do dry breath holds as part of my morning routines.
Right.
Okay. And then I do go out in the water. Like we have some nice dive sites and stuff like that. So, you know, if I have Chris around, then, you know, we'll go out and then he'll spot me while I, you know, do some free diving locally.
Now, you've just mentioned your husband's name, Chris. What's Chris' surname? Second name?
Olson.
Chris Olson. Shout out to Chris Olson. A great training buddy. So there you go. Stuntman extraordinaire. Married to Laurie. There you go. Well, you know, there is, I'm just thinking of some of the projects over the years that I've done, and we've had to go outside of the industry because I'm surrounded by so many martial artists and gymnasts and stunties who spend hours in the gym and on the floor and, you know, who walk gingerly on rocky riverbeds and it's very hard to find good people who can operate outside in the natural environment as if it was comfortably, I guess it's the, I judge a lot of, you make a lot, what am I trying to say? Over the years, what I've done when I'm working outside is that I look at what people wear on their feet. It's a good indicator of their experience, or what kind of footwear people wear. And I was in the forest the other day and somebody was wearing a nice shoes in the forest. And it was actually, as the day went by, we started to just notice the change in the color of the shoes. And it was the person's first job, actually, outside of in the real environment and not used to it. And people's raincoat. And the weather's can be a good teacher at times of what not to do again. Hey, Laurie. We could talk forever, but one thing I do want to just find out a bit is, can you just talk a little bit about your blog site? Because this is this other side of you that keeps you busy. You've got a blog and you talk about food. And is that somewhat related to your lifestyle as a stunt woman, or is that something completely separate, or is it are the two connected in any way?
Oh, yeah, a little from column A, a little from column B. When I was trying to slim up for the Siren role, one of the strategies I used was intermittent fasting. So I kind of did a lot of research on ways to, I didn't want to just lose weight. I wanted to have a sustainable way of eating and living that made it easy to stay slim. So it wasn't, you know, like, I don't believe in fad dieting and then, you know, rebounding. So I discovered intermittent fasting, which is basically restricting your eating window to a shorter period of time so that your body naturally goes into what they say is called ketosis, and your body burns your fat for fuel rather than food. And so I started with doing that. And then in learning about that, I learned about the keto diet, which is a nutritional way of achieving the same goal. So you eat more fat as your fuel rather than carbohydrates. And then you're, if you do it repeatedly over a longer period of time, your body learns to do that as its natural way of energizing itself. And it's not for everybody. Like, you know, it doesn't take for some people as well as it does for others. But for me and for my husband, we found it, you know, like a really easy way to eat and live. And we love the food and we love the lifestyle. So it really suited us. And I love cooking just in general. So for me, I like the creative challenge of trying to convert all my recipes over into keto and, you know, high fat, low carb. So for me, it was an enjoyable learning experience to play in the kitchen and, you know, be creative with my cooking. And in doing that, I take photos of things and put them up on Facebook, and people are like, oh, can I have the recipe? I'm like, well, I don't really have it out there, so it's not easy to share. So eventually I was like, you know what, I think I'd like to just make a blog, and that way it'll be almost like my own personal recipe book too. I can go back to and reference these recipes for my own use and then share them with other people, because people seem, every time I share a photo, I'd have five people saying, what's the recipe? So that's why I decided to do the blog. And my husband, he built it for me so that I could, you know, post on it on a daily basis. You know, he's got skills with web design. And then of course it wasn't just the keto. I kind of said, well, I'd like to also put in my stuff on my outdoor adventures too. So that's why it became Feed and Flow. So I had outdoor adventure stuff. I've got my keto, you know, lifestyle stuff. And it just became kind of like this passion project for me. And what's funny is that I have a lot of people saying, oh my God, you should just write a recipe book already. I was like, no, I do not want to do that with this. I've written a book before. I know how much work it is and how little payoff there is for that work. I'm happy for this to just be a passion project and not make any money from it whatsoever. Because they say one of the ways to make yourself miserable is to take an enjoyable hobby that you do for free and try to turn it into a minimally paying side hustle.
You know, listening to you talk, I think I've just found a title for this podcast. It's going to be called Feed and Flow. I think it sums up our conversation really well. And I'll explain it later in my summary of it. But feedandflow.com sounds good. And I just looked at the chicken recipe you did recently, and it got me going. So I'm actually on cooking tonight. I'm somewhat disappointed that, you know, like, I just feel like we need to do a part two, part three, and it's something that I'd love to do further with you in the future. I just feel like we're scratching the surface with you, and we haven't even talked about the depth of how you went into your martial arts, and of course that's paying dividends in terms of your career as well. There's a whole bunch of other things that, you know, in time, what I'd like to be able to do is just repeat this conversation and come up with part two. And I'm also fascinated to see your journey over the next, particularly 2 to 3 years. Now that you've got a tip of cord and set, and just on that, is there enough people that you're in your eye line, I guess, that is offering you some kind of role models apart from the people who are already there that you can see from where you're at right now, who have careers that are are kind of aligned with where, perhaps where you want to go in terms of coordinating? Is there enough coordinators that you're aware of that that you know that you probably the, whose careers you want to sort of emulate or parts of it anyway?
I don't know if I really have an answer for that because I don't know if I have the strong vision of how I see myself as a coordinator yet. Like, I'm just starting to scratch the surface right now. And I have some broad skills. There are certainly a lot of people who are better fighters than me, who are better in the water than me, like, and who have, or who have just generally wider skill sets than me. And that's not to say I don't have something to offer. But what I think that my background that I think is quite strong is that I have a much more a stronger managerial mindset, like having worked in real jobs and, you know, like I have a degree in communication, you know, from university that I put to use for a long period of time. Like that gives you a lot of skill sets for dealing with production and multitasking and working with different departments. The risk assessment stuff is combining what I've learned from stunts and having kind of, you know, shadowed with coordinators to some degree and learned from them while on the job. But there's also the just being able to sit and think critically when you look at a script and break it down and think about what risks might be presented there too, and being able to read into things that might not be there, read between the lines, you know. I feel like there's a certain level of maturity and life experience that comes. It's not really something you can get solely from working in film. Also with the communication too, like, you know, if you get too, you know, dug in on some being things being a certain way and not being able to be flexible and to let, you know, let stresses roll off your back and like, I guess, you know, of course, film can present those opportunities to be good at that too, but like, it's just different. And also the organizational mindset, like being able to kind of compartmentalize what needs to be done and delegate. I think those are really important skills that you don't necessarily, you know, have from just performing. I don't know.
No.
There's no one coordinator I would look at and say, hey, this is the person I want to be in 10 years, though.
I think it's actually a trick question, and I think you answered it really well. And I think the best, you know, you'll just become a great coordinator yourself. And yeah, no, good call. I tried that. I looked at people, and then I started to get disappointed because I could see their flaws. On that note, let's stop today. And I just want to say thank you. And what a great conversation. And I'm going to actually watch Sirens. And I'm going to get through season one. I've just got to try and find the time to do that. And I think I'm a big believer in binge watching just because it's consistent with my week to week. And I'd love to find a series of nights where I can just binge watch at least one season of that show. I'm sort of getting back into fast turnaround TV. Well, not TV, but new media is presenting itself with challenging content and requires a different type of approach from doing feature films. So I'm quite keen to look at what you guys did, particularly in the water and other stuff. I keep telling some TV producers that I feel really unqualified to do it. So I'm hence why I was really asking you about how your team was structured and do you find, how do you find the, Justin, say for example, Siren, you've got a season coming in, you're the lead double, over a period of what, 3 months, 4 months, they shoot the season?
Yeah, it was around that.
Yeah. So do you just scratch out that whole period? I'm committed to this show and anything else that comes in is bonus. Is that how you process it? Because sometimes in some shows, Lee Double is a great credit, but in some cases there might actually be more work as a, you know, as a secondary double to somebody else or as a generic player. And I see the importance of having a credit as a lead double. Was do you often have any concerns about going into a season about that you're committing to an entire block of to a 3 or 4 months or to one character? How do you process that? Is it
It didn't prevent me from taking other work, fortunately. I mean, there were times where I had to say no to another job just because there was a conflict. But overall, I didn't feel like I lost out too much. Plus, I think what I may have lost in other opportunities because people see me, oh, Lori's lead double on that show. She might not be available. So sometimes I might not have gotten a call where I might have otherwise. Mm-hmm. I gained in experience of working with a team that's cohesive, and I loved our team on Siren. Like, Ed was an amazing coordinator who always tried to help us learn and as much as we could on the job so that we'd become better rounded performers, as well as like the water team, like getting to know Roberta, and who is our, you know, like I got to train under her before, but then I got to work with her in the water and then learn from her, you know, like I'd help safety. I'd learn about, you know, waiting actors, like, how, you know, trying to get people's buoyancies correct. Also helping actors in the water with their performances. And like, I just got to learn so much from our water team days. And it was an invaluable experience. And now that's why people go to me as a water performer, because they know I have all that experience and that, I'm not going to be awkward, you know, like I have a lot of time spent on it. And I know all the teams too. Like it was like, it's a very specific team we have in Vancouver that does 90% of the water work. So I we're all very familiar with each other.
That's very cool. Wow. That's awesome. Well, thanks for that. This is, we're going to come to the end of this conversation with Lori O'Connell, Stuntstruck. She's an ordinary person doing extraordinary things with her career. It's incredible. Hey, well, look, thanks for that. It's really cool. Gosh, so good listening to you talk about it all, particularly Sirens and your life. Have you got work this week?
Be sure to check out Haunting of Bly Manor. That's the one that just came out on Netflix that I worked on as the lead double.
Right. I'll have to change my VPN paper to find that. But yeah, no, that's cool. And that's cool. Well, I hope that we can probably meet in some great part of the world. Hopefully Chris can make it too on something. There's talk about a gigs up in the Caribbean in the new year. It's